Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. This week, I'm joined by Michael McMullen once again. And this time, we're talking about players we've interviewed. It's quite a free-form format, this one. We're just sort of yakking, really, about players we've interviewed, what we've learned from interviewing players, the best players to speak to, and I guess what journalists are looking for when they interview snooker players.
So, the media discussed. Well, we were just saying before we came on, we're going to start by talking about our first player interviews. Yeah. Mine was 20 years ago now. It was at the Welsh Open, 1998. And I was working then for the WPBSA. Not something I mention very often, but I was. And I just started there. And I went over. It was the first tournament, I suppose, I went to, really, in an official capacity. And there was a young player who was doing well called Paul Hunter, who'd won a couple of matches and he was seen as sort of a rising star. And the Bruce, who was my boss, said, why don't you go and interview him? Which was difficult because I hadn't interviewed a player before and Paul hadn't really been interviewed that much before, and he didn't know. And the thing is, in those days, now there's like media training and all that, and no one in those days told anyone how to do it.
So, including the journalists.
Including the journalists, yeah. So it was kind of difficult. He was very shy at the time just because he'd never... I think he felt a little intimidated maybe by just, you know, the journalists coming and asking him questions. And it wasn't great. He, of course, in the end, and not very, didn't take him very long to get really good with the press. Really, really good. Yeah. And it was always a pleasure to interview. But, yeah, I suppose it was... We were both sort of learning how to do it, in a way.
How did it go?
It went okay. You know, I didn't get loads out of him, but that was partly my fault. I'm not blaming him at all. But, yeah, I think the point about this, and maybe we'll come on to this during the podcast, is everyone's different. Every player's different. Some players, I think, get it. They understand what journalists are after, which is a decent story. And that doesn't mean a bad story, it means a story. Other players come in and just want to talk you through every shot they played, which, frankly, no one cares about, you know? So that was my sort of baptism of fire.
Well, the thing about that is the players must have been queuing up to get interviews, be interviewed by you after that, because, of course, he won that tournament.
Yeah. I mean, I don't necessarily take any of the credit for that, but, yeah, he did, yeah. And of course, the point with that was, because he did so well and won that tournament, and became a winner, he then got used to being interviewed.
Yeah.
And therefore, after that, he was great. He was really, really brilliant, Paul, always. So that was my first time.
Well, I started with probably the best player you could possibly start with, Ken Doherty.
Yeah.
Because he's just so good to deal with. Yeah. And, I mean, I was a student at the time. It was 1996. And we had a college radio station. And it happened, it was like a one-week thing that you did in your final year. And it happened to be the week of the Irish Masters. So I thought, wouldn't it be great to get Ken Doherty on and, you know, record an interview and then run it during the Irish Masters? And unbelievably, when you think about it, I mean, I was just some student, and I could have been absolutely anybody, but I rang, I think they were called Q Masters at the time.
Yes.
Ian Doyle Stable changed their name a number of times, and they just gave me Ken's phone number. And I rang him up, and he was like, yeah, no problem at all, come round my house on Sunday. Wow, this journalism's easy, isn't it? Yeah. I can honestly tell you that's the last time I was ever invited to a snooker player's house. But I went round on a Sunday afternoon, and it was about 1 o'clock, and his mum answered the door, who sadly departed last year, and she said he wasn't up yet.
This is such a Ken story. Oh, everything totally. About this is a Ken Doherty story.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I actually, while I was waiting, I think it was about an hour before he finally came downstairs, and his mum gave me tea and scones, and she was telling me about some French woman who had come to the house to interview Ken not long before that. Now, who has ever heard of a French snooker journalist? Yeah. And she was saying how she was quite scantily dressed, and she was asking her why she hadn't put her skirt on. I mean, this was all before I'd even heard the interview. I thought this interviewing thing's fantastic. Yeah. You get this entertainment. Yeah. But then the thing was, of course, this was the first time I'd used this radio recording equipment. Mm. So I started asking Ken, my first question, and then thought, this isn't recording, is it? And I said, sorry, Ken, I'm going to have to stop there. So now it was actually working perfectly.
Right.
he actually seemed to be more comfortable with the equipment than I was. Oh. But actually, if there's a tape of that in existence, which I doubt there is, the tape actually starts with me asking Ken the same opening question about four times. Oh. Because it was only about the fourth time that I became in any way convinced it was actually recording. Mm. But that was my starting point. But, you know, what a great way to start. Yeah. You know, some people, in maybe more likely in other sports really, might think, oh, this guy's just a student, you know, I'll have a bit of fun with him. And
well, they should. I mean, the idea of who's sort of equivalent in the world of tennis, it wouldn't be a Federer but someone not
Krychek.
Too far off that. Yeah.
Say Krychek, because he won Wimbledon around that time.
The idea that you would get his number off his manager.
Unbelievable.
B, to be invited around his house, which is unthinkable.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, but, you know, there was none of this kind of, oh, you know, I'm going to, you know, I don't know, make fun of this guy or anything like that. I mean, Ken just was, you know, as he always is, was just so respectful and so good. And actually spoke to me like he probably would to any other a much more experienced journalist. So, I mean, that was a great way to start. If it had gone, you know, the opposite direction, you could be scared off.
Yeah.
But, that certainly gave me the taste for more, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I interviewed Ken a lot because I did a lot of the Irish papers and, you know, win or lose, he would always answer in sentences, if you know what I mean.
Yes,
he would actually give you an answer, and he wouldn't hide the fact he was disappointed when he lost. It wouldn't just be sort of platitudes. He would speak honestly, but he would speak. And that's the point, you know, if you're looking for quotes, A, you want them to say something, and B, it's got to be something meaningful. It can't just be literally anything. It's got to be something that you can use. And him and Fergal O'Brien, you know, always very, very good. And I think that's, you know, you're either like that or you're not. But I do think, and of course Ken's gone on to work in the media. He was one of those players, as I was saying at the start, I think he always understood what the media actually wanted. He spent a lot of time in the press room, which maybe helped. He got to know the journalists.
Well, even that day in 96, I remember him saying, he was asking me, because I was doing the journalism course at the time, and he was asking me all about it, and he was saying, oh yeah, no, later on in life I'd love to be involved in media. And of course he does his own sports radio show. I don't know how many people outside Ireland know about that, but on a Dublin radio station on, I don't know, is it Saturday or Sunday mornings, but he does say, and it's not snooker by any means, like there's some snooker on it, but it's all sports really, so he's on the other side of it now. But one thing I really learned, and I'm sure you found this too, you know, you'd only ever really seen snooker players being interviewed on television before, and it's a bit more formal setup, but a press conference, particularly, you know, which is mostly print guys, or certainly was in those days, it's so informal. I mean, it really is just like a chat. And you get much better stuff there. And it took me a while to get my head around that, because you'd go in and you'd see the likes of Phil and John Dee and Trevor Baxter and Clive. These guys have been around for years. And it was just so casual with the players. And I just couldn't get my head around that for a while, actually. But of course, you know, you get far better stuff by talking to players that way. And, you know, at that time, it was, you know, a regular group who went to every tournament and became so familiar with the players. So, I mean, there were no barriers there at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say, you know, it was all better in my day. Actually, correction, I do want to say it was all better in my day. It was different because, like you say, because newspapers actually had more power. So you'd have this little core group of freelancers who would travel the circuit, and obviously they'd get to know the players. And also, and this doesn't really happen now, the players would come in the press room a lot, and they'd sit in the press room, and therefore they'd get to know the journalists. So that sort of any barrier between the two was immediately broken down.
I remember seeing Stephen Hendry sitting in a press room one day, as was often the case. He was just reading a paper, and somebody, and I don't even think it was one of the regular press, just went up to him and said, Stephen, can I talk to you about such and such a thing? He just nodded his head. 5 seconds later, they were already into the interview. Yeah. Now, again, can you imagine that happening? And, you know, you're talking about the greatest player of all time, you know, in many people's eyes. You know, can you imagine sitting down, you know, Tiger Woods coming into, you know, a media centre, you know, reading a paper, and Tiger can have a quick word. Oh, yeah, sure, man.
But that's
it just wouldn't happen.
But that's the sort of the irony in a way that Hendry would come in the press room, because when he went in the players' room, he would get bothered by friends of players.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Ronnie made this point about the numpties, and what one of the things he was saying was that you go to one of the qualifiers, and all the aunties and the uncles and the grannies and all come along. They want to get now selfies. Then it would have been autographs. And Hendry obviously, you know, was trying to like stay focused in the tournament. He wouldn't get that in the press room. It's sort of almost an unwritten code. If he came in during the interval in a match, he'd sit quietly, read the paper, you wouldn't speak to him. But if it was on a non-match day and he came in, then, like you said, it was fair game to go over and say, Stephen, as you're here, would you mind sitting down? And he would always do it.
Oh, yeah. No, very, very obliging. And, you know, it just highlights, I think, the general ordinariness of the top snooker players.
Yeah.
They're just really, really ordinary people. They're not affected by it. I think that's something to do with the nature of snooker and the sort of mindset you need to have. And, you know, you can't be, you know, full of big ideas about yourself. And very, very few of even the greatest players, you know, ever have been. And obviously that's made our job a lot easier over the years.
Yeah, although, of course, I say, like, on a non-match day, Hendry, very obliging. On a match day, if he wins, brilliant. If he loses...
Oh, yeah.
Now, I mean, I'm not going to roll out the Shrewd story again, but why don't you... Because you were there as well. So why don't you tell that story from your perspective?
So what was it? It was against Drago, wasn't it? And... Now, you were still the press officer at the time.
Hanging on, yeah.
And I can't remember the exact circumstances of the match, but I know, like, Hendry had about 300 chances to win it. And
Drago had a few flukes.
He had a few flukes, yeah. And the crowd were really getting on Drago's side, actually. And then Hendry comes in, you can imagine.
And it's just after he's lost to Campbell 9-0 as well.
It's just after he's lost to Campbell 9-0. It's the same year that Higgins has overtaken him as world number one. So you can imagine the mood he's in at this stage. He comes in, he sits down. I mean, my word, I mean, the atmosphere.
And there's a lot of journalists there.
There were a lot of journalists, actually, because... You know, snooker was at a real peak in Ireland at the time because it was, you know, Ken was at his peak. So Hendry comes in and nobody says anything. Mm. But of course, you were the one who had the responsibility of getting something going. So you said, obviously it's disappointing, Stephen. And he just turns around and says, Shrewd.
But it was the contempt, quite rightly as well.
Well, if you think of that, you know, sarcasmometer the comic book guy had in The Simpsons, you know, which just exploded.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it would have just gone through the roof at that stage. And after that, a few more people tried questions. I mean, even Phil, who was really good friends with Hendry and still is, I mean, you know, was asking questions, and Hendry was just, you know, shrugging his shoulders and just saying absolutely nothing. And literally, Shrewd was the only thing. Most of us actually were sitting there with our heads down. Mm. Nobody wanted to make eye contact with you or Hendry, you know. And I actually, some months later, I went. I was looking through my notes, and I'd written down Hendry .. Shrewd and just presumably just to have something to do to avoid eye contact, I'd actually put quote marks around the word Shrewd.
I
never saw anything as extreme as that, you know, in snooker or any other sport. But I mean, I'd had it earlier in the year when he was struggling. He'd lost his first match in the Irish Masters, and I asked him something or other, and he just basically turned and kind of snapped at me a bit. But do you know what, I think I don't think either of us really minded that kind of thing, because we were huge admirers of Hendry, and we knew that was just part of what he was like. He hated losing, which was why he won so much, and we just accepted that as part of the package. And it was almost a badge of honour to be Hendry's in those days.
Well, it was a better story as well for him to say
one
word than to just trot out sort of meaningless platitudes that no one was interested in.
Yeah,
and he had earned the right to be severely disappointed, as you say, like a great champion. He's going to hurt if he's in a bit of a slump. Of course, later that year he won the seventh world title. Had a bit more to say then.
He's still talking.
Yeah. Now, Steve Davis, I didn't cover the sort of glory years in the 80s. Mm. And it's interesting, towards the end of his career, he was the opposite. You couldn't shut him up in press conferences. I remember I had to walk out once just because he was going on and on and on. And I think there were some guys there who didn't cover snooker very regularly and were just delighted to be speaking to Steve Davis. And he sort of got up and he said, had enough, have you? You know, all that sort of thing. Because he just went on and on and on. And why not? You know, again, he's earned the right to say as much as he liked. But I guess, when you're at the very top, also, like, you've been interviewed after every match, win or lose, any tournament, you're coming in. And I guess after a while, and of course, it's straight after the match as well. You know, you've got no time to collect your thoughts.
That is the thing. I mean, it would be better in one sense if you could have half an hour in between, which is actually what happens in other sports, like, say, in football. Mm. You know, you don't speak to the players till half an hour after the match. In snooker, it's not really possible, and I think a lot of that is because, certainly in those days when, you know, there was a lot of newspaper coverage, the deadlines were really tight. Obviously, a lot of the matches finished late, so if you had any chance at all of getting it in the paper, you needed to speak to the players straight away. And also, it's not like the players are going back and having a shower in the dressing room, you know, straight after the match. So the obvious time to do it is straight after. And inevitably, players end up saying things that that they regret. Or that they look back on later and say, well, look, I didn't really mean that. I probably felt I meant it at the time. Mm. There's a lot of that. It's like Judd Trump at the World Championship last season, you know, when he refused to speak to the press after the match against Rory McLeod. I'm sure 10 minutes later, once he'd cooled down a tiny little bit, he probably regretted that. So in one sense, it's probably the worst time to talk to players. In another sense, it's a brilliant time because you're far more likely for them to say something extraordinary. But you know, you talk about Steve there, you've got to remember the difference, even not so much in terms of his, not just in terms of his standing. When he was at his peak, he was the most high-profile sportsman in Britain.
Yeah.
So, although it was a very different media world, he didn't have Twitter and all the rest of it, you know, if he said anything out of place, it was going to be massive news. And, of course, he had Barry guiding him, you know, and was very keen that, you know, there should never be any scandal surrounding him of any level whatsoever. So I think maybe that was part of it, that perhaps later on in his career, he was less high-profile, the game was slightly less high-profile in the media, he had a bit more freedom to say what he wanted, and Steve, you know, a bit like Ronnie now, you know, would just go off into all sorts of topics in his press conferences. But again, it was great. You got great quotes and great lines.
Well, you've dropped the Ronnie bomb there, so let's introduce it. I mean, obviously, you know, this huge fascination with Ronnie, and I mean, his press conferences, you could write several books on them, really, because they've like sometimes it's very much from the heart and very kind of raw. And I've seen him. I remember at the British Open in Newcastle, when he was clearly in the midst of a depression, and you could see it in his face, he just looked in a terrible place. At other times he'll come and have a laugh and a joke. There's clearly times when he relishes being able to just say what he likes and talk. Other times it's difficult to get something out of him. I mean, obviously last season he wasn't saying anything at one point to the media.
He was singing though.
He was singing, yeah. But I guess all of that is kind of Ronnie's personality, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just so unpredictable. You just never know what he's going to come out with. I remember talking once with a completely straight face about the prospect of getting married to Ray Reardon.
you can do that now.
Yeah, well, this is it. You know, back then, it wasn't even legal, you know. But look, if you're going to talk about... You see, this is the difference, you know, with, you know, a lot of interviews, it's one-on-one, it's just you and the player. But most interviews with players are actually in a group environment, in a press conference. And, of course, there's one Ronnie press conference that I think, you know, stands out head and shoulders above all the rest. Was the one in Dublin in 2004. He'd played, it was Ebden, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He just played quarterfinals of the Irish Masters, and he conceded a frame, 10 red still on the table. And he came in afterwards, and I thought, well, look, you know, he obviously wants to be asked about this, he's looking for a bit of attention, so I'm just going to ask him straight away. And I said, so Ronnie, why did you do that? And he said something about, oh, well, you know, I wanted to get off and have a cup of tea, and, you know, sometimes you got to do what you got to do. So I thought, well, you know, I'm going to take him up on this. So I said, but you didn't have to do that. You know, what do you mean you got to do what you got to do? Yeah. You know, there was nothing about that. So then he said, yeah, you're probably right. And, you know, maybe if I had your head on my shoulders, I'd be a 10 times world champion by now. Now, as you pointed out, quite where that would have left me, you know, is another matter. But there was all kinds of stuff there. And he said, some days you're the bug and some days you're the windscreen. I mean, one of the great quotes, that. Yeah. Then he invited us to go on a night out with him in Dublin.
Yeah.
There was a German guy there who actually asked him to repeat everything slowly so that he could understand
it. Yeah, and bear in mind that it was about a half-hour press conference.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I think you got up and walked out of that one as well, because it was something to go up and... Sort of
people have got lives to live, haven't they? Yeah. You know? They've got things to do.
But it was like, you know, it wasn't just Ronnie lending to the absurdity. You had the German guy, you had an Irish journalist who... That was the one and only season of a thing called the LG Order of Merit. One of the Irish journalists asked him, you know, are you disappointed that this result will affect your chances of winning that? I mean, it really was. I think you wrote about it in Snooker Scene, saying fans of the absurd would greatly have enjoyed Ronnie's press conference. But he was loving it. He was actually sitting there kind of smiling and joking all the way through it. It really was just an absolutely extraordinary thing. And then, funny enough, having conceded, basically thrown away that match, about an hour later he was on the practice tables next to the press room.
No, it was vintage Ronnie, but I guess it's another opportunity for someone like him, who's a great crowd pleaser, to play to the crowd. Because you say, a lot of people there, and maybe he hadn't enjoyed the match that much, but it was an opportunity to kind of have a bit of fun. And I guess, in some ways, that's maybe what the player should treat it as, because sometimes they come in, and clearly they've got no interest at all in speaking to anyone. But it is part of the job, and if they're wondering why they're earning hundreds of thousands a year, it's primarily because of the media, because the media showcased the sport.
Oh, complaints totally because of the media, because if there was no coverage, you know, there'd be no sponsors, there'd be no prize money. I think a lot of players get that. I mean, you talk to someone like Sean Murphy, he's never grumbled about speaking to the press. And, you know, he actually pointed out that, you know, some of the players who do grumble should take a look at the example of Paul Hunter, who we mentioned, who continued to do interviews and press conferences during the darkest thing you can possibly go through. Graham Doss, when he had a major illness going on in his family, came in and spoke at the Masters and made the effort. And I think you know, I mean, that's so commendable. And players who complain about it should consider, well, look, you know, there's a lot worse things could be going on in life than losing the snooker match.
Mark Selby, I think, is an example of, I mean, he now gets interviewed a lot, obviously, as world champion, world number one. But I think he's an example of someone whose maybe personality doesn't come out as much in interviews, because I think he sometimes feels a little bit on edge by it. I don't know. You know, you've seen Mark, we're at the Championship League at the moment. Backstage, he is kind of the jester, isn't he? He's having fun and very nice to everybody, treats everyone the same.
Sure.
Maybe he's an example of someone who maybe just closes up a little bit. Mark Williams could be a bit like that as well at times in interviews.
Yeah. No, they're definitely true. Actually, both of those would be the best examples of that. You know, but again, you know, they've come into a very different environment now that, you know, everything gets picked up on, and, you know, people aren't interested now, a lot of people, certainly in media and social media, in, you know, hearing you make positive comments. They're only interested in catching you out.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the environment that, you know, top sports people are dealing in now. Mark is, you know, probably next to Ronnie, the most high-profile player there is. And, you know, he's all about the snooker. He wants to be out there winning matches. He doesn't want to do anything. He's got nothing to gain by saying anything that's going to get him in any sort of trouble whatsoever. And he just plays it very straight, which is a bit of a shame. And, you know, it would be good to see him, you know, bring out a bit more of that personality. But you can totally understand why he does it.
I think that's the thing with social media now, that journalists would used to sort of lead. They would ask questions at press conferences and they'd go and report what had been said. Now, the tendency is a lot of journalists have to follow what players are putting out themselves, sports people are putting out themselves on social media. And for anything that's been said in a press conference, there could be something sort of bigger just been said on Twitter that then suddenly everyone has read and you've got to sort of react to. But you're not, you don't have any part in that conversation, you're just sort of observing it, really.
Well, I read a book by Neil Harmon, the tennis journalist, recently, and he was saying he almost doesn't bother with press conferences now, that he would have enough of a relationship with the players that he'd collar them for a word on the way out of the press conference. Because as he was pointing out, everything, you know, good or bad, even that's said in the press conference, ends up, you know, being, you know, published online somewhere, you know, within moments of it happening. So it's a very different environment now. You know, you compare that to what we came into when it was all about newspapers and you were still reading your copy over the phone.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about that,
yeah, I know.
You know?
Yeah.
Totally different world in that sense.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people, it's quite fashionable to sort of look down your nose at journalism, but I think we need it more than ever, actually. You look at the state of the world, an actual hard fact, you know, would be nice rather than just sort of endless opinion and speculation. And those days where you did have the sort of the regular crew going around, I mean, in some ways it could be a little bit cosy, maybe, you know, it was a little bit of a clique, which I was part of very happily. But also they would look after the players. I mean, there was a famous occasion, and this is years ago now, when Darren Morgan lost to Dave Harrell in the Asian Open final.
Oh, yeah.
And did what you were describing, immediately came in the press room and started to sort of lambast everything, Dave, himself, everything. And the journalist actually said to him, Darren, why don't you go and take 10 minutes to calm down and come back in? Now, in another scenario, they could have just reported his sort of explosive comments and made him look really bad. But actually they were thinking, no, you know, we don't need this. Just go away, come back, calm down. And then I think he was still a little bit, you know, annoyed, but he calmed down a little bit. That wouldn't happen in football, for example, would it?
And it wouldn't happen nowadays in snooker. No. People would be sitting there salivating, thinking, this is brilliant. Because Darren Morgan was, you know, was very much a top player at that time. But he loved to give out about the world. But it was just, you know, amusing as much as anything else. Some players, I think, you know, just have a very good attitude to it. They want to have something to say, but they're just not used to it. You've got to remember, like, a lot of these guys haven't even really had, you know, a full formal education. So it's very, very difficult for them. And, you know, as well as that, some of them, you know, the kind of life they lead doesn't lend itself to great answers. Because I remember one player who I won't name, because he was actually really good to deal with over the years. I was doing an interview with him when he was starting out, and I'd been asked, because it was for a magazine, ask him a bit about his lifestyle and what he does outside of the game. And he was really trying very, very hard. You know, he's obviously just played a lot of snooker. And eventually, after about a minute of trying to make out that he had all these hobbies outside the game, he said, yeah, but mostly I'm just down the pub. Which was almost certainly true.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult. You know, you get some players who have, you know, a good attitude. It's not that they don't want to give anything, but they find it very, very difficult. And, you know, we're comfortable with the sort of media environment because, you know, we've spent our working lives in it. You've got to remember, you know, there's no reason why someone who's really good at playing snooker should be good at speaking to the media. Yeah. Thankfully, quite a few of them actually are.
They have now, there's a kind of media training scheme.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure exactly what that training is, because I was sort of asked my opinion on it a couple of years ago, and I'd seen a thing on Sky. There was a sort of behind the scenes thing on Sky where Sky Cricket, where they took some younger county cricket players basically to go to the pub with a load of cricket journalists. Mm. Just, I'm not saying they got drunk, but they just went and socialised with them, got to know them, like I was saying, like, pleasure to come in the press room. And to me, that's arguably more valuable than sitting someone down in front of a whiteboard and telling you, okay, if they ask you this, say this, and don't give this away, and mind how you sit and all that. We don't want that, actually.
No, we definitely don't. And I mean, I'd say it's one of the few sports left now where you might actually have a drink with the players.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure over the years, you know, pretty much all the top players, we've had a drink with them at one point or another, and, you know,
we've allowed them to buy us a drink.
We have, yeah. Well, look, they can afford it. But, I mean, that totally breaks down the barriers. Formal training, I don't know how much value there actually is in that. I think it has a certain amount of value, but as you say, it can produce sort of formulaic answers. Mm. I remember, didn't we see some slideshow that had been shown to young players, and it said something about journalists being ego-driven and lazy.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, how dare they suggest that about us?
Yeah, I know, shocking. So, to conclude then, a player coming in, turning pro, bit of potential, is going to be of interest to the media. What advice could we give them about dealing with the media? I guess be yourself would be a good way to start.
Yeah, because you know what? If you're not going to be giving great answers and great statements, that's just who you are, and it's not really going to change. And of course, certainly from our point of view, we want them to be themselves and we want them to show their emotions, you know. And if they are greatly disappointed, then, you know, let's hear about it, or at least show it in some way. And as you say, sometimes even things like the Trude incident or whatever, you know, that can be a better story. And I mean, I remember one player, current top player, but when he was an amateur, I was covering an amateur event, big amateur event, and he lost in the deciding frame of the semi-final. I went up and said, "Can I have a word with you?" He nodded his head. I asked him one question. He started crying and walked off. Now, he was only very young at the time, but, you know, if anything, you'd love it if that happened to a top player. They'd probably be greatly embarrassed. But, you know, and not because you would want to make them look bad or ridicule them or anything, but, you know, it'd just be fantastic to see that sort of level of emotion. So, yeah, I suppose be yourself is the only thing. I would say the best thing to do is almost not give them any advice.
Mm.
Let them go in. And as you say, Paul Hunter, who was so uncomfortable with it at the start, but just by doing it and by doing interviews and warming to it, I mean, he became wonderful to deal with in his later and more successful years. You must have, though, you know, some really, you know, bad story. I don't mean reflecting a player in a bad light, but just about an interview or something that went badly wrong.
To be honest, a lot of the problems I've had have been actually arranging the interview.
Oh, yeah.
Like, because one thing with snooker players is, if you say, "I'll meet you here at 2, it'll be 3, probably. Well, that's how they turn up a lot.
The following day.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And just getting people to ring you back and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, I mean, there's been, down the years, have been, usually when someone's lost, you know. One thing I'll say about this podcast, everyone who's been on this podcast has just said yes. No one's ever refused to come on. I haven't asked everyone in the game, obviously.
No one's
ever refused to come on the podcast. You know, and you can just sidle up to a player and say, "Will you come on?" and they'll do it. And that's great that there's not that barrier. You've got to go through agents and managers. I think it depends what mood they're in. Sometimes people have things going on that you don't know about off table, and that will affect their mood.
But I think you know when to pick the moment.
Yeah.
And that is actually, I think we would both agree, a key thing in arranging interviews is pick the time to ask the player.
Yeah.
You know, you can see what kind of form they're in. If they're chatting to the other players and joking, you're not going to say to them after they've lost 5-4 in the black, "Do you mind, you know, doing a half-hour interview tomorrow?" So you do learn to gauge these things. Well, one thing, you know, I would have to say, you know, when you've more foreign journalists now in the game, and there can be a bit of a language barrier, and they're also coming from a slightly different sort of media culture, you get some really, really strange questions.
Yeah.
Like the night Stuart Bingham won the World Championship, he was asked afterwards, "How do you figure out the angles for the shots? Is it through a formula of geometry?"
Yeah.
Which was just the strangest thing. And Stuart actually handled it well. He said, "I just couldn't honestly answer that question." And I think the same journalist had asked Sean Murphy, who had just lost a fairly close world final and missed out on the chance of a second world title 10 years after his first, "How would you have felt if you'd been playing a woman tonight?" I mean, it's just so strange, but it's just a very different media culture. It was all very sort of British-based, you know, when we were starting out. And it's something that the players have to get used to now in the modern game.
Well, in China as well. In China, you get some very strange questions, and also they're all translated, so they take forever to sort of come back. And famously, when Ding won the China Open for the first time, he beat Ebden along the way, Peter Ebden. And the first question to Ebden, so it's 5-0 he's lost to this young kid. And the first question was from this Chinese journalist, "Ebden, not Peter, Ebden, how come you win World Championship?" And to be fair to him, he handled it really well. I suppose you have to, really. It's funny. I mean, I think my advice to players, as I say, would be yourself. And also understand that snooker journalists in particular, and journalists in general, they're looking for a story, and not necessarily a negative story. I've seen so many times where people have tried to sell a really good story about the game that makes players look good. They don't always get in the papers because sports editors aren't always interested in that. But there's no real general agenda. You know, we're just trying to report the game.
Some people, non-snooker specialist journalists, can have a bit of an agenda. They come equipped with one. And I'll give you an example. The World Championship in 2000, John Parrott, 12-8 up against Joe Swale in the last 16. Joe comes back to win 13-12, comes in talking about his recently departed mother, and he was in tears, and what it all meant to him to be in the World quarterfinal. John comes in, and I mean, John Parrott, like, you know, great to interview, and would never want to be at the centre of any controversy. So he comes in, and I think Joe had beaten him a few times over the previous couple of seasons, and he says, and in tribute to him, saying, great player, and he's been a real pain in the neck to me over the last couple of seasons. Now, he didn't mean it in any sort of bad way, he just meant he keeps beating me. He was reported the following day in one of the papers as, you know, fighting behind the scenes, you know, among the players, calling each other a pain in the neck. So you've got to be wary of that sort of thing. I mean, that's always been around to some extent. People like that have the agenda, but I suppose if you're a specialist snooker journalist, you don't want to fall foul of any of the players. And the thing is, it's not just the player in question you'll fall foul of if you stitch him up, because he'll talk to other players because they speak to each other so much. And, you know, you could really damage your future prospects for any sort of interviews and that. And it's generally worked pretty well over the years, I think, the relationship between, you know, the established snooker media and the players.
Yeah, and we'll end with Paul Hunter, who we began with. Of course, famously, because he learned how to just be himself, actually, and had confidence to speak as himself, he ended up on the front page of a couple of newspapers after he won the Masters for the first time with that Plan B stuff. And that was just an example of not being media trained and not being told what to say, just being yourself. And, you know, what a credit to the sport. So that's it. That's the media. And that's the end of this podcast. Thanks for listening.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.